Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to make the right decision in a life or death moment? Last January, Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger was in command of a U.S. Airways flight 1549 when, less than 3 minutes after takeoff from LaGuardia Airport, a bird strike shredded both engines. Realizing they were unlikely to reach any runway on land, Sullenberger and his co-pilot called for passengers to brace for impact and landed the plane in the icy waters of the Hudson River. Amazingly, all 155 souls who had walked aboard that day left the plane alive. Captain Sully Sullenberger is in town for a signing of his new book. It's called Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. We are honored to have him with us for this hour. Sully, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris, and it's great to be back home in Texas.
Yeah, you're a Denison native.
Grew up, went to high school there.
I want to start by playing the recording of your communications with air traffic controller Patrick Harton on that morning. We'll listen now.
Cactus 1549, turn left lane 270.
This is Cactus 1539. It burns through cross thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
Okay, you need to return to LaGuardia. Turn left heading of 220.
220.
Tire, stop you to park. He's got emergency returning. It's 1529. Bird strike. He lost all engine. He lost the thrust in the engines. He's returning immediately.
Cactus 1529. Which engines?
He lost thrust in both engines, he said.
Got it.
Cactus 1529. We can get it for you. Do you want to try to land 1913?
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
Joey 2760, turn left 070.
070, Joey 2760.
Hi, Cactus 1549. It's going to be left traffic to runway 31.
Unable.
Okay, what do you need to land? Cactus 1549, runway 4 is available if you want to make left traffic to runway 4.
ADS, okay,
I'm not sure we make any runway. What's over to our right? Anything in New Jersey? Maybe Teterboro?
Okay, yeah, off your right side is Teterboro Airport. Do you want to try to go to Teterboro?
Yes.
Teterboro Empire, actually LaGuardia Departure Guy, emergency inbound.
Hey, guys.
Cactus 1529 over the George Washington Bridge wants to go to the airport right now.
Wants to go to our airport, check. Does he need assistance?
Yes, it was a bird strike. Can I get him in for runway 1?
Runway 1, that's good.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280, you can land runway 1 at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in the Hudson.
I'm sorry, say again, Cactus.
Sully, I can't hear. I know how it turned out. You know how it turned out. I can't hear that without sort of holding my breath and feeling my heart race. Can you listen to that without a physical reaction?
Of course, I've heard it many times.
Yeah.
And not only have I heard this, but I recount in the book, Highest Duty, how back in June, my first officer that day, Jeffrey Skiles, and I actually got a chance to listen to the cockpit voice recorder, which, of course, in addition to having the radio transmissions recorded on it, it has all the voices, the sounds, the warnings that were happening in the cockpit. And I've heard this recording many times, but it still takes me back there in the drama of the moment. That at one point in that recording toward the end, you hear that wonderful air traffic controller that day, Patrick Harden, whom I've met, sound almost in disbelief. He told me later that he had heard what I'd said about going into the Hudson, but he asked me to say it again because he just couldn't quite wrap his mind around that concept. And he thought that he would be the last one to hear anything from anyone on the airplane, and didn't know for quite some time afterward. I talk about that in the book too, the agony he went through for 45 minutes or more after being relieved from his position and until he found out that we had a great outcome.
Because they'll take these air traffic controllers off the scene immediately when there's been a crash.
Yes.
And they do a urinalysis and make sure that they're not drinking.
The same as they do for pilots.
Yeah.
And of course, everything turned out fine. But yeah, he was shaken to his core. At one point, he sent a text message to his wife and said, "I had a crash. Not okay. Can't talk now." And she thought he'd been in an automobile accident. It wasn't until later that she knew the enormity of what he had faced.
One of the things, I think this is very interesting, that you explained that one of the things he did right for you was to not just keep jabbering and throwing information at you. He knew enough to keep quiet because there were these other conversations that we didn't hear in that tape taking place between you and your co-pilot.
Exactly. And we also had 208 seconds from the time that we hit the birds until we landed in the Hudson River. And in several places in this recording, you can hear that I don't respond to him right away. And that was by choice because there were more important things I had to take care of. And talking to Patrick at that point, I determined wasn't going to be helpful.
First thing you said to Jeff Skiles when you realized what had happened, you said, "My aircraft."
Well, that happened very shortly afterward. And again, part of what I do in the book is I take the reader inside my head as I'm making these important decisions. We had seconds to decide and minutes to execute a plan that would ultimately save the lives of all 155 passengers and crew. But my first thoughts were very human ones of disbelief. When we struck the birds and the engines began to roll back and began to lose thrust, it was this amazing, intense physiological adrenaline rush that I felt to my very core. And when we lost the thrust, it felt like the bottom fell out of our world. It felt like the forward momentum of the airplane nearly stopped. And I quickly compartmentalized and took stock of the situation. And I took the two steps that I knew from my experience would do us the most good. I turned on the engine ignition so that if there was a chance for restoring thrust, it would happen automatically. And I started our auxiliary power unit, our APU, which is a small turbine engine in the tail that's used for air conditioning and power supply on the ground and can be used in the air for a backup source of electrical power, which is a very important thing in this particular airplane, being a fly-by-wire airplane. So it wasn't until after I'd done all those things that then I said to Jeff, "My aircraft." And even in the throes of this dire emergency with an extreme workload and extreme time compression, Jeff responded immediately in verbatim with his part of the protocol, which is, "Your aircraft." It was important that we acknowledge this transfer of control protocol so both of us clearly understood not only which of us was flying, but that also assigned our roles and responsibilities for the remainder of the flight.
Thinking about how seamlessly you two worked together, it took me extraordinarily by surprise to learn that you hadn't really known each other before this particular trip that you were flying.
We had never met before 3 days before this happened. And people may not know, but that's one of the other things I do in the book is I take you inside the airline world. And for a large major airline where you have 5,000 pilots and maybe 10 or 15,000 flight attendants, it's not uncommon at all for us to start a trip to fly with someone that we've not only never flown with before, but perhaps never met before. And, of course, the only reason we can do that is that we're all trained to such a high professional standard that we become essentially interchangeable. And you wouldn't be allowed to watch us work in the cockpit, especially now since September 11th. But if you were, and if you were observing me watch, if you were watching me fly with somebody I'd never met before, you couldn't tell that we hadn't been working together for years because our coordinate. We both know the scripts, and we know our roles and responsibilities, and we work together very seamlessly and pick up immediately as a team.
Let's talk about knowing the scripts because, incredibly, it really seems as if yours is a story in which your whole life, literally, the focus of your work and the things that you've been passionate about was leading up to those 5 minutes or so in that aircraft.
Well, I think it turns out that I'd lived my life in a way that turned out to be a pretty good preparation for the event that day and for all the attention in the aftermath. And I think I'd lived kind of a thoughtful, considered life.
And you had focused on safety even sort of outside of your regular work.
I'd always continued to invest in myself. I had a real curiosity, a love of learning. And so I would find out about things that I thought were important to me or that interested me. And because I found my passion so early, and that's a great gift, a wonderful advantage I had, I literally knew at 5 years old I was going to fly airplanes. And I was just fortunate enough to actually be able to do it my whole life. And so I think when somebody finds their passion, they're willing to work harder at it and become more expert at it. And I think they'll also derive a lot of satisfaction from it. I mean, quite frankly, it's a lot of fun being particularly good at something that's difficult to do well.
And even at 16, when you had your first solo flight, you didn't have that sort of hot dog sense that people associate with teenage boys. You were sort of measured and careful and wanting to get everything precise even then.
Well, you know what? I had lots of fun, but I didn't do it with reckless abandon. I would kind of think about it first. And I even then, I understood that I needed to manage risks intelligently. And so, yeah, you're right. I didn't take a lot of stupid risks, but I did learn as much as I could and become as good at it as I could be.
My guest this hour is Captain Sully Sullenberger, a U.S. Airways pilot who guided Flight 1549 into a landing in the Hudson River after losing both engines to a bird strike in January of this year. His new book is called Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. He's in town for a signing tonight at the Borders store in Dallas at Preston and Royal. You are welcome to join our conversation right now by calling 1-800-933-5372. We're also going to take a quick break in this fascinating conversation. There are times, Jeff, when you and I find it almost impossible to stop. But we are doing fundraising this afternoon, and we have to do that even when we have a fascinating guest. So we would ask that you please give us a call right now at 1-800-456-5372. If you would like to receive, as your thank you gift, a copy of Sully's book, Highest Duty, we have that available at the $120 contribution level this afternoon.
Yeah, you can pick that up if you join as a sustaining member of the station. It's $10 a month. It's an easy way for you to support the station. Kind of in a worry-free way. It's an easy transfer from your account to KERA's account each month. It's $10 a month, and we'll thank you with the book. Or you can use your credit card, which most people, about 95% of people do. They call 800-456-5372 or do it online at kera.org.
It only takes about 2 minutes, so literally you can pick up the phone right now or go online right now and be back in plenty of time for the conversation to resume right after our next break, so you will not miss a single word of what Sully has to tell us. If you would like to make that contribution immediately, you can just pick up the phone, 1-800-456-5372.
I want to thank Cynthia Slaughter in Fort Worth and Jack Hudson in Dallas. They've done their part. Also, Brent Smith in Norman, Oklahoma. Thank you, Brent. And Sasha Passage in Dallas. Thank you so much, Sasha. Don't forget, everyone who pledges online at KERA.org or via the phone at 800-456-5372 this hour gets entered into the second think drawing of the day. Now, you're still entered into the all-day drawing for the Fort Worth Opera deal that we've been talking about all morning. But during Think Today, during this hour of Think, we have two pairs of tickets to tonight's Found Footage Festival at the Lakewood Theater in the Lakewood area of East Dallas. It's at 8 o'clock tonight, and you'll see all kinds of crazy videotape stuff that these guys, one of them is a producer on the Colbert Report, so they know funny. They do know funny, and they're really funny. It's they're on stage, and they roll the videotape, and it's a lot of fun. So we're going to draw two winners. And each of those winners will be plus one at the Found Footage Festival tonight. And we're going to draw that at the end of the hour. So call now.
Regardless, you win another great year of radio. And, you know, one thing that is always really gratifying on this program is that we have an hour to talk to Captain Sullenberger. We don't have to get this into a soundbite amount of time. You always get the whole interview unedited. Sometimes that's a for better or for worse reality. But we don't sort of talk to somebody for an hour and a half and then pick out little bits. You hear the whole thing. And you have the opportunity to interact yourself as a listener when you call in or when you send email to the show. We think that it's worth it to support this kind of public radio being produced for your community, in your community. The telephone number to be a member of the station is 1-800-456-5372. You can also go online to kera.org. Again, we have a copy of Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters, available as a premium, as a thank you gift. We know that you're not buying the book for $120. You can pick it up. Maybe you will pick it up at Borders for $25.99 and get it signed this evening by Sully. We encourage you to do that.
Absolutely.
Just also think about making your contribution to KERA. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. Again, you can also get to us, you can do this all online at kera.org. Use a credit card, set up a sustaining membership, choose the level that is right for you. We do appreciate everything, and we will be back speaking with Captain Sully Sullenberger in just a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, the U.S. Airways pilot who guided Flight 1549 into the Hudson River after losing both engines to a bird strike in January of this year. Everyone survived aboard the plane. His new book about the account is called Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. You can meet Sully tonight at a signing that takes place at the Borders Bookstore in Dallas at Preston and Royal that takes place at 6 o'clock. Best place to find information about that is on the Art and Seek homepage of KERA.org. If you want to join the conversation now, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You chose your words to the passengers very carefully.
I did. And even though we didn't have much time because it's such an intense workload, time-critical situation, I did take several seconds to decide what to say. And I chose two words very carefully. I chose the word brace because that has specific meaning in terms of the flight attendant's crew's training. That's a signal to them to yell their own commands, which in this case was brace, brace, heads down, stay down. The second word I chose was impact because you have to realize with no thrust, our rate of descent was much greater than for a normal landing where you normally have some engine thrust to shallow your descent to the runway. And since that wasn't possible for us, I didn't know how successful I would be in trading our forward speed for a reduced rate of descent to cushion the touchdown. So it was imperative to avoid passenger injury during the landing that they be in a good brace position. So I said simply, and I tried to say it very directly and matter-of-factly without any agitation in my voice, this is the captain, brace for impact.
Those are words that I have to imagine it is your worst nightmare to have to say.
Well, I certainly never expected to have any of these things happen. In fact, one of the more difficult things about our profession as pilots these days is that things work so well so often, you have to really be vigilant. In an instant, you have to be ready to handle an ultimate challenge that you know may never occur. It's possible these days for an airline pilot to go through an entire career and never experience an actual failure of even a single engine. And that was the record I was looking for after 42 years of flying until this January. So it requires great vigilance, and you have to work very hard to avoid complacency and to be ready for whatever might come, no matter how unanticipated it might be.
So then you get the plane into the water. You don't cartwheel or do anything. You sort of, as smoothly as you can, given the circumstances, you get there. But it's January in New York, and it's 21 degrees outside and 26 degrees in the water. So then there's the immediate deadly problem of hypothermia.
Exactly. And we had solved, by safely landing, the biggest, the first problem of the day. But we by no means had solved all the problems. We still had to do a successful evacuation, and we still had to have a successful rescue. Now, fortunately, the point in the river where we landed was directly between two important ferry terminals in Manhattan and in New Jersey. And on the Weehawken, New Jersey side, the New York Waterway employees actually watched us land. They described it as looking like a flume ride. And on their own initiative, they contacted via maritime radio their own ferry crews on both sides of the river. And within 3 minutes 55 seconds of us stopping in the river, the first ferry arrived.
Of course, these ferries are not designed to fish people off the wing of an airplane. What did they do to get people out of the water?
Well, that's another interesting part of the story. Since September 11th, there are regular rescue drills that all these operators do in the river. And, of course, the Coast Guard is involved in maintaining safety standards. But this particular operator, I was told, had gone beyond the minimum requirement and had recently installed fairly new devices called Jason's Cradles. And if you could imagine a Venetian blind with rungs like ladders, it's flexible, that can be pulled up via a pulley system. It's possible to extend it over the deck of the bow of the ship into the water. And the deck of these ships might have been 8 or 10 feet above the waterline. And for those who don't have the strength or who are injured and can't climb up the rungs of these ladders, they have a way via this pulley system of pulling people up to the deck level. And that was actually done in the case of one elderly woman.
Sully, how long was it until you knew that everybody had actually survived?
It was about 4 hours, the longest 4 hours of my life. It wasn't until about 7:40 p.m. Eastern time that evening when my crew and I were in the hospital being evaluated and waiting to go to the hotel. After we had done all we could, we'd made all the notifications, we'd verified that the passengers and crew who were injured were being treated, And I'd been bugging the authorities for hours trying to find out if, in fact, everyone had been accounted for. I knew from my own direct observation that there was no one left on the airplane. But what I did not know, because people had been taken to both sides of the river, the New Jersey side and the New York side, and some had been taken to hospitals, some had gone elsewhere, I didn't know for 4 hours that, in fact, all 155 had been accounted for and were all safe. And when I finally got the word that it was official, it was the what I describe in the book as my life's single most intense feeling of relief. I felt like the weight of the universe had been lifted off of my heart.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the lines to Barbara in Ennis. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Just wanted to congratulate Captain Sullenberg once again. I had been a flight attendant way back when, and I was wondering if the APU, the auxiliary power, hadn't been working, how would that have affected your ability to land the plane as you did? I know personally that there have been times that we didn't have auxiliary power on the ground.
Well, hi, Barbara. In this particular case, as it turned out, it would not have made a great difference. What that allowed me to do, without getting too technical, is to stay in the normal flight control law on the flight control computers, which mediate the pilot's stick movements, and in interpreting those, they decide how much to deflect the flight control services. By having the backup source of electrical power, we maintained electrical power to the flight control computers the entire time. What that allowed us to do is to have some flight envelope protections, and the flight control computers would prevent us from maneuvering the airplane to either fly too slowly or too fast or too steeply. But in this case, we never exceeded any of those parameters, so it really wouldn't have had a great difference in the outcome.
You write in the book that you never, throughout these moments, believed you were going to die. And in fact, you were so focused that you didn't think about what people would imagine, that you didn't think about your wife or your daughters. You were laser on the task at hand.
Well, I had to be, didn't I?
Yeah.
I mean, we had so little time. In fact, when I talk about when Jeff and I first heard the cockpit voice recording in June at the NTSB headquarters in Washington, you know, I didn't think that time had slowed down for me, and I still don't. But I thought that day, that my memory of it was more accurate than it turned out to be in terms of the cadence, the pace of events, because I knew it happened quickly. But when Jeff and I heard the cockpit voice recording for the first time in June, it was stunning. It was shocking. It took my breath away. It happened so much faster in reality than even in my memory. It was amazing that we got so much done in such a short time. But I knew at the time that it was a race against the clock, and there was simply no possibility of anything distracting me from the intense focus that we had to have to fly, to analyze, to act, to decide, to control the flight path. In fact, at one point in the book, I say that late in the flight, that I felt as if my entire consciousness existed solely to control the flight path, and that was all I could focus on.
So many people have contacted you since this happened. You tell a really beautiful story in the book about the daughter of the captain of the Value Jet flight that went down in the Everglades in 1996. Will you tell us that?
Teresa Hunsicker is also living in Texas. Her father was the first officer on the Value Jet flight that crashed in the Everglades a number of years ago. And she wrote us a letter that was one of tens of thousands. But this was one of the ones that moved us the most, among a handful. And she said that she had been haunted by the possibility that her father, when he died in that crash, that fiery crash, had died in agony and in regret. And the NTSB investigators at the time had tried to reassure her that that was not the case, that he died doing his duty as best he could. But she didn't feel satisfied and had always wondered about that. But something about seeing me on the interviews that were done back in January reassured her that the way she heard me describe this process and the focus that I was able to bring to bear on these issues and these problems indicated to her that probably her father had a similar focus and a similar devotion to his duty to the very end, and that it reassured her. And she wrote us a long letter. In fact, it was such a moving letter. My wife, Lori, actually called her, and they had a woman-to-woman, wife-to-wife conversation about about just these issues. In fact, they've had several conversations, a more recent one also. And she was gracious enough to talk to my collaborator, Jeffrey Zaslow, who helped me with Highest Duty, and who also helped Randy Pausch with the last lecture very successfully, to interview her and to make it a big part of the book. It brings such this human emotional content to it. It really makes this an everyman story. I think it is very illustrative of how many lives this story has touched.
Was it hard for you to get back in the cockpit?
No, not at all. The only difficult part of it was managing how noticeable it was obviously going to become. It took months of planning on the part of many at the company to pick a date when everyone was available, including our CEO, to pick a flight to make it all happen. But as far as getting back in the cockpit, of course, it was wonderful to be reunited with Jeffrey Skiles, my first officer from January, when we flew again together 3 weeks ago. And actually, some of the passengers from January found out that we were flying together and made it a point to be passengers on that flight as well, some of them sitting in their original seats from the January 15th flight. So it was a very familiar place. You know, it was like coming home.
Was it equally easy for your wife and daughters to let you go that day?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the difficult thing now is finding the right balance between family and everything else.
Yeah.
Because I've been working harder in the last 8 months than I've ever worked in my life, including when I was flying full-time and trying to start a business. You know, this story has generated so much attention that it's provided amazing opportunities for us and a chance to have a greater voice in things I care about, including aviation safety, a chance to make a difference in many important ways. But the workload has been tremendous, especially in putting out the book. And so we're still working on finding the right balance. And some days I don't need to be a public figure. Some days I just need to be a husband or a father and nothing else.
It's hard for you, I guess, to walk through the world now without people saying, hey, I want to give you a slap on the back.
Well, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy. On the one hand, people, I think, really understand that I wasn't seeking celebrity status, that this was really thrust upon me, that I wasn't prepared for it in a special way. It was just an instant notoriety. And they approached me very graciously. They say, do you mind? May I shake your hand, take a picture, get an autograph? But at the same time, because they know I'm a regular guy, I'm very approachable. They don't mind coming right up to me.
Yeah.
But, it's kind of waned over the months. I think with this book, it's picked up again. But, it's like it's my new job. And I feel an intense obligation to do what I can for the things I care about, my profession, aviation safety, some other things. And that's a very good thing, having these opportunities. But if I can be the public face of a very remarkable event that I think reassures people about human nature and gives them hope, then I'm more than willing to do that.
Captain Sully Sullenberger is my guest. His new book is called Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. We'll resume our conversation with him in just a moment and ask right now that you take the intervening lull when it's just Jeff Whittington and me talking to you to pick up the phone and call. Make a pledge of support to KERA. Allow us to keep bringing you fascinating guests like Sully Sullenberger. Our telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. You can also do this online at kera.org. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a fascinating conversation, and I think we have definitely entered the, gosh, this is just so interesting that I'm not going to call in pledge zone. And if you are listening and you're just, there's a full board of callers.
Snap out of the wall.
I'm getting emails on my email from people listening. I'm getting texts from people who are listening. And I know this is fascinating. It was hard for me to break away to come in here. But that's why we're doing this, is to give you a moment to call us at 800-456-5372. To go online to KERA.org, you can pick up a copy of Sully's book at the $120 membership level. It's in stores, though. We would encourage you to go get it and still contribute to the station. We just want to make it as easy as possible for you to do your part for public radio in North Texas.
1-800-456-5372 is the number. You can also go online to kera.org. You know, Jeff, we read a lot of really interesting books for this show. There aren't too many that I literally literally can't put down. But I was walking through my house, you know, like changing out the laundry last night when I was studying, and I had the book in my hand because I didn't want to set it down. It is that compelling.
You do laundry, Chris Boyd, of KERA's Think program?
Yes, hard to believe.
Wow.
We have more unwashed socks in my house than I'd like to admit.
You're ruining people's dreams.
I got four kids. We got to do laundry.
You're not ruining Mark Cerny and Murphy's dreams, though, or Margaret Allison in Fort Worth. They have called or joined online. Also, Joshua McGuire and Denise Prue in Dallas. Hopefully I'm saying your name right, Denise. We also heard from
Tracy Holmes in Dallas, Karen Cacopardo in Dallas, Jeff Ensign in Aubrey, Rebecca Wright in Dallas. Lots of you are calling. We do, however, have lots of capacity, so please pick up the phone now. Give us a call at 1-800-456-5372. Our guest this hour, of course, is Captain Sully Sullenberger, who is no stranger, we should say, to Dallas. Hung out at the Inwood Theater as a kid. He grew up not too far up the road and went to eat at El Chico as a treat on weekends.
Yeah.
Occasionally.
Yeah, and grew up in Denison, birthplace of Dwight D. Eisenhower, as a matter of fact. I lived just south of Denison in Sherman for a year myself in college, so know it pretty well. This is a real treat to have Captain Sullenberger as our guest on the show today. And we know that you appreciate the opportunity when we have folks like this, when we have guests every day, actually, to call in and participate in the conversation. That's what this is all about. We do this show for you. And we try to make it during the membership campaign time as easy, as enticing as possible. And to that end, we also have a drawing this hour, just this hour. You join online at KERA.org or call 800-456-5372 right before the next break. So you got to do it right now. We're going to draw two winners, two names, and each of those people gets two tickets to the Found Footage Festival tonight at the Lakewood Theater in East Dallas at 8 o'clock. It's lots of fun, and it's a great offer. And they're offering us these tickets because one of the creators is on the Think television show tomorrow. So you can check that out as well if you don't win the tickets. But somebody's going to win these tickets. So don't wait. Call right now.
1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go to KERA.org. You can receive a copy of Sully Sullenberger's new book, Highest Duty. Of course, this is at the $120 level. We always say this, you're not buying the book. We actually buy the book and then send it to you and then just deduct that from the overall amount that you've donated to KERA. If you want your whole contribution to go to programming, that's fine too. Just, you know, pick up the book when you're out and about. If you can find a copy, because apparently it's going to be number 3 on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list.
It is. It's a pretty big deal, and we're really excited to be able to bring you this conversation today on the show. So please follow the lead of Allison Olson in Plano, Carla Garber in, looks like, Joshua, and Wanda Kelly and Wendy Kelly in Dallas, and call 800-456-KERA.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, the U.S. Airways pilot who guided Flight 1549 into a landing on the Hudson River last January. All 155 people aboard survived the crash. His new book is called Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Dennis in Arlington. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, I just wanted to ask Sully about the bills that are going through the House, what he thought of those, and what his experience was in check rides, and whether he had had any check ride busts in the past, that he could talk about check rides and how they affect us. I'm a regional pilot at a company. I've been there for 10 years, and recently that's been a big issue at the regional level.
Thanks very much for your call. Now, check rides, that's all inside baseball, so tell us what that means.
It's basically a test. A practical knowledge test in the flight simulator, and it can involve, you know, oral questioning about knowledge, about aircraft systems, how things operate, about procedural things that you have to know, and part of it's just physical manipulation of the controls, but much of it is what I would call head work, you know, the judgment part of it, you know, the planning, executing of it. So it's really all three. It's knowledge, it's planning, it's execution. It's a practical test, and unlike other professions, you know, like medicine, for example, professional pilots have to demonstrate competence on a regular basis. And I think that's a very good thing if it's done properly. And, Dennis, I'm not quite sure what your are you having increasing busts at your operation? Is that what you're saying?
Dennis, you know, go ahead.
Not any specific recently, but the recent Buffalo accident brought up that issue, and there was a proposal coming through, I believe, the House about single check rides basically being an ending of career issue. And if you could talk to, you know, what it means to bust a check ride and then continue with the airline with, you know, possibility of what is coming through the House.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You know what? I haven't read that bill in its entirety, but what I do know about it in one other important area I'm very much in favor of, and that is the issue of experience. Let me give you a little bit more background on that, since we do have a format where we have a time to have a full conversation, which I very much love. One of the ways that historically we've been able to make commercial aviation in this country so ultra-safe, and prior to February, we had just gone a little over two calendar years without a single passenger fatality among the major jet U.S. airlines. And that's an amazing statistic. We're talking about millions of passengers, you know, tens of millions of flights. One of the ways we have been able to do that is the airline operators have been choosing to greatly exceed the FAA bare-bones minimums in every area. We've had margins for our safety for a lot of years. Now with this economic downturn and the intense competitive and cost pressures, I think what we're seeing in some areas is some operators not having as great a margin above the FAA minimums. For example, when my first officer that day back in January, Jeff Skiles, was hired by a regional airline, a commuter airline, early in his career before he started at U.S. Airways with a major airline, he had several thousand hours already of flight experience before he began as a first officer on a turboprop commuter airplane. Now what we're seeing is some new hire first officers with a few hundred hours of experience. And part of that's due to the salary structure, quite frankly. The first officer on the Colgan Air airplane that crashed in Buffalo was making $16,200 per year. She had concerns about calling in sick because she couldn't afford to pay for her own hotel room and wanted to get to the end of the day where her company would provide her a hotel. So one of the things that this bill would do, if enacted, that the House passed a few weeks ago, would for the first time require that first officers, that's the co-pilot on an airliner, have the same grade of pilot license that the captain has to have. And right now that's not the case. Only the captain has to have an airline transport pilot certificate, or ATP, license. The first officer currently can have only a commercial license, which is the next level down. And there's a vast difference in the experience levels required for each. The commercial certificate requires only about 250 hours of flying time. The ATP, 1,500 hours. That's much different. So if this bill is enacted, one of the things it would do and positively affect the experience level is require that we have much more experience for new first officers on the smaller airplanes.
Let's talk about compensation for a minute, because when you say something like $16,000 a year, I think about that, and then I compare the amount of money that it costs people who don't come up through the military system to become certified pilots, and those things just do not jibe.
Yeah, sometimes they have, you know, almost like doctors, they'll have huge debt, $50,000, $100,000, it's not, you know, unheard of for all the flight training and education to get these licenses that you need to begin. So, you know, compensation matters. And one of my overall messages is that economics and safety share a link, that they affect each other, and that we as a society must value this this business, this profession sufficiently that we can continue to attract the best and brightest to it, and that they won't instead choose to go to medicine or law or finance or some other profession that might seem more desirable and a much better use of their talents for their family's well-being. So, but we can't rely only on the investments made by previous generations. We have to continue to make new investments going forward, and these investments in aviation safety can't only be in technology. They can't only be in the system in which we operate. They must be also in people.
Let's go next on the phone to Sandy in Arlington. Hello, Sandy.
Hi. Captain Sullenberger, this is Sandy. I am a retired 36-year flight attendant with a major air carrier here in Dallas, and I just wanted to thank you so much for including the flight attendants from the day one of all of this publicity, because so often when something like this happens, the cockpit's brought into it, and the flight attendants are kind of left out, like they didn't have anything to do with anything. And just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate your positive efforts on all of this, and we appreciate you.
Well, thank you very much. You know, that's something I've been working on ever since January 15th with limited success. You know, the way the world works is that they tend to make it about one person. And I've been reminding people for months that it's been about at least five, and that's not even counting New York Waterway and the ferry captains and the first responders. But not only did our first officer, Jeffrey Skiles, have a great contribution, but Donna Dent, Sheila Dale, and Doreen Welsh, our flight attendants, certainly did, and also Patrick Harden, the air traffic controller.
Yeah, people often forget that the primary duty of a flight attendant is passenger safety as opposed to passing out beverages and snacks and telling people to...
Yeah, they're there for safety reasons. And they work really hard on every flight to keep you safe and being prepared for whatever might come.
Did you, before this ever happened, ever run through your mind the possible scenarios that might come up and sort of fantasize about how you would respond? Or was it simply a matter of keeping yourself trained so that you knew how to instantly react?
I think it was a combination of both. I mean, you know, each of us tries to anticipate and we wonder how we would handle certain scenarios. But quite frankly, not even in the most extreme training scenario in the flight simulator had we practiced anything even remotely like this. We certainly had practiced parts of it. You know, we certainly practiced engine failures. We certainly practiced other things. But we wouldn't have practiced the entirety of this scenario, losing both engines simultaneously at such a low altitude and low speed over such a densely populated area with so few options and so little time to deal with it. That clearly was something I had personally never trained for. So what we did was we built on what we did know. And so we were able to quickly assemble what I call already learned procedural building blocks and stack them up one on top of the other in a step-by-step process to solve the next problem that we faced until we'd finally scaled and surmounted a challenge that seemed at first almost insurmountable.
No one will ever take anything away from your extraordinary skill and the decisions that you made. I wonder if you ever indulge in the kind of thinking that, gosh, if this had been another airport that didn't have the Hudson River right there or didn't have a place where you could touch down with relative safety or if there weren't river crews ready to assist. Do you even go there, or is it worth your time to go there?
You know, we certainly did some of what just human nature early on, the distracted thinking, the what-if-ing, the second-guessing. I mean, that's just part of the classic PTSD. You know, you can't sleep, you can't shut your brain off. You read a magazine for two or three sentences and you have to go back and read it again because you really can't focus. That went on for a few weeks or a month. But after a while, after you process it, once the information became public from the investigators to verify that our understanding of the situation really was correct, then what we found out was that we really did make appropriate choices at every juncture. We really did have a good understanding of what was going on, and that we really did do the best that we could with the situation that we faced and the time in which we had to face it.
What happens now when you greet the passengers and say your name? Do you hear a cheer resound from the airplane?
Well, you know, I flew a couple of flights about 3 weeks ago, and on the first one, it was a learning experience for me. So the second one, I did a little bit better. And so what I do now is I have to wait for a few seconds after I get on the PA and say my name for the cabin to quiet again so they can hear what I'm going to say next.
It has been an absolute pleasure to have you in this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Chris, it was a real joy. Thanks for having me.
My guest this hour was Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger. His new book is called Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. You can meet him tonight at the book signing that takes place at the Border Store in Dallas at Preston and Royal. That starts at 6 o'clock. There's a link to that on the Art and Seek homepage, which is kera.org/artandseek. It has been a wonderful hour. We know that you all have been listening, as we have, on the edge of your seats to this story. It was such a pleasure to be able to have Captain Sullenberger in here. Now, however, that this portion of the show has come to a conclusion. So it's safe for you to draw your attention away for the 2 minutes it takes to make a telephone call to support KERA, to let us know that, you know, vote for this kind of programming with your dollars at 1-800-456-5372.
Chris, our colleagues are lined up outside to meet Captain Sullenberger as he leaves our Our boss went in and said, I want to meet you.
We've had Nobel laureates in here. We've had, you know, but I don't know. We had Andy Williams the other day. I don't know that anybody matches the star power of this extraordinary American.
I mean, you do something like that, and you're. I mean, we listen to the tape. You're cool. You're collected. You're kind of a bad dude when you do something like that. That's pretty cool. So 800-456-5372 is the number to call. Donna Castles did it. Maybe she went online at KERA.org. Adam Shedd in Lake Dallas. Donna was calling from Carrollton, by the way. Beth Huddleston in Dallas. Thank you so much for your support of the station. And I think we're going to draw for those tickets to the Found Footage Festival here momentarily, but still have time to call.
You've got time under the wire.
800-456-5372, online at kera.org. And at the $120 level, you can get your very own copy of Sully Sullenberger's book, written with Jeffrey Zaslow, Highest Duty, My Search for What Really Matters. I'm reading it upside down here. It's fascinating. It's got the transcript in it. It's got the air traffic control transcript or transcription of the recording we heard, but also what happened and what was said in the cabin of the plane to the passengers as well.
And that was what he talked about just having heard himself in June. Jeff and I looked high and low all over for a copy of that, but it has not been released to the public. This is he and Jeff Skiles talking to each other, but the entire transcript is in the book. We would love to be able to send you a copy. Of course, you can buy one anywhere, but if you want to join at the $120 level, this is our thank you gift for the hour, and it is a really, really good read. Call right now to get your copy, 1-800-456-5372. You can also do this online at kera.org.
And we've got some winners.
Jason in McKinney and Elizabeth, I don't know if that's a location or a last name, Levy. But Elizabeth,
congratulations.
We'll be contacting you in some other way, I'm sure. Yeah. The tickets are at will call and all that, but we'll get in touch.
Each of you and a friend will get to see some hilariously funny found footage tonight at the Lakewood Theater. I went last spring when they were here, and Nick Brewer, one of the co-creators, is going to be on the TV version of Think tomorrow. We're going to have some excerpts from their found footage festival to run as well. Some of the dating tape excerpts
boy.
Are hilarious.
Makes me glad to be married.
So you will have a good time. So thank you so much to each of you. Of course, everyone who has contributed today is entered into this drawing for the Fort Worth Opera package as well. So it's just, I mean, it's giveaway city at KERA this week.
And we give away great radio 365 days a
That's
year.
Right.
The thing is, we can't give it away for free. We provide it to everyone in North Texas based on the generosity of the people who think it's important to not only like the content, but to support it. You know, it ultimately, this is not a guilt trip, I promise you, but it does come down to your values. It comes down to, are you someone who thinks, gosh, this is great stuff, I hope other people keep paying for it? Or do you say to yourself, wow, there might be somebody who paid for it last year that's in a tough spot this year and can't do it. Maybe I'll step forward and do it.
Yeah. And you know, and even if it's a little demoralizing that we're still in the membership campaign, you know that this is how we do it. Even if you're grumbling about it, quite frankly, some of you know who you are on your social network page status updates.
We read those, people.
We do. And occasionally we respond to them. You can still call 800-456-5372 because you know you're still going to tune in. You're still going to tune in and try to time it so you can miss the pledge breaks. I know what you're doing. So do your part. And you know what? The drive will be over before you know it, and you'll have done your bit, and you'll feel good about it.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can go online to kera.org. You know, Jeff and I always talk about this, but we are regular listeners. And because we're regular listeners, we too are delighted when the membership drive is over, when the entire hour of something we're listening to is over. But here is the God's honest truth. This is the only efficient way we have of raising money from listeners. If we had advertisers, of course, that's not going well in the commercial world really these days, but this is how we do it in public radio. We don't beat around the bush. We come to you and say, please give us some money. We sugarcoat it with a thank you gift, but we even admit to you that that's not really a gift. It's you pay for the book and you pay for part of your contribution.
Yeah, look, here's the deal, okay? About 12 days a year on Think, you hear 7-minute interruptions in the program. We don't edit anything out. We come to you live. We say, hey, we're taking a break to ask you to call 800-456-5372 to support your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. But if this was a commercial station, We take those 7-minute breaks 3 or 4 times an hour every day. Not 12 times, not 12 days out of the year. Or I'm sorry, it's more like 22 days out of the year, something like that.
It just flies
It'd
by.
It'd be every day out of the year. Every day, every hour, there'd be these huge breaks. So, you know, you're getting a lot out of KERA.
You know, you heard Sully Sullenberger say it was great to be at a venue where he got to express an entire thought and go into something in depth. If the guests recognize it, we know you, the listeners, do. Please give us a call right now and make a donation at 1-800-456-5372 or go online to KERA.org. Thank you.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.